Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast dedicated to all things cycling, walking and wheeling in the UK and beyond. I'm Adam Tranter.
And I'm Laura Laker.
And this time we are Nedless because there is still a bicycle race happening over in France, apparently. But Laura and I are going to get through it somehow with or without, no, well, without our third musketeer, not with or without, definitely without. To put aside any rumours, the last couple of podcast episodes, I've not been in them and Ned has, so it's not that me and Ned have fallen out or anything like that.
I don't think anyone was thinking that apart from you.
I started to worry, actually, when he said he couldn't make it. So today we're talking about cycle training. All cyclists start somewhere, whether that's wobbling along with stabilizers or without on a balanced bike, as I taught my kids with. In the UK, because we often end up sharing the roads, we have to have quite a prevalence towards cycle training because many of us will have to get used to using the roads rather than using dedicated infrastructure. So we might have had some experience from a professional at some point, and that would probably have been under the bikeability standard or cycling proficiency before that, as it was once known. In recent years, cycle instructors have increasingly voiced concerns over pay stagnation and working conditions. And now this summer, London instructors are striking for the first time ever after what they describe as a 14-year pay freeze. The freeze, they say, amounts to a 50% real terms pay cut. So to discuss that today, we have two guests from the Independent Workers Union of Great Britain. That's the IWGB. It's Swami Hosha, chair of the cycling industry branch of the IWGB, and Ben House, who is the co-secretary. Welcome to Streets Ahead.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome. It's great to have you here because your plight has been in the news a lot, and I've heard from cycle instructors for years now, you know, how difficult things are getting. And I was quite shocked to find that so many instructors had stopped working. I think half of instructors stopped during the pandemic in London. And so it's gone down from something like 300 to 150. And apparently on average, they're losing one instructor a week in London at the moment, which is quite shocking. So do you want to, I mean, you might have feelings. I saw you kind of make eye contact with each other when Adam was talking about cycling on the roads. You might have feelings about like why we need cycle instructors. So it might be a nice place to start if you wanted to tell us about that.
Swami, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I've always ridden my bike. And when I moved to London in 2005, it wasn't a straightforward transition into cycling until a tube strike led to me borrowing a friend's bike. And then that was a new chapter in my life. And I've ridden every day pretty much ever since. And I went on to study sports science at uni, and I've always had a passion for cycling and obviously, you know, human performance. But it wasn't until I had my first son in 2015 that I realized that cycling on London roads with the name fund wasn't for everyone. And a change of career and life circumstances led to me learning about the profession. And, you know, I've always been an advocate for cycling, helping friends in my own way to get cycling. So I thought, why not make that into a profession? And so I trained up in 2017 and I've been an instructor ever since.
And how about you, Ben?
Yeah, I moved to London in 95 and spent the first couple of years traveling on public transport and buses, because whenever I'd lived anywhere else, I'd always cycled, but I heard that it was too dangerous to cycle in
similar
London.
Story then.
Yeah. But I got fed up sitting on the top deck of the bus and watching other people on bikes and decided to start riding. I lived in a top floor flat, got a Brompton, and I've been riding ever since. But when I discovered that, you know, cycle training was a profession that, you know, we could get into, I trained as a cycling instructor, and I've been working as a full-time instructor since 2016.
So as a profession then, obviously when you came into it, you probably didn't know too much about it. Now having been involved and now being involved with a union, what are the kind of misconceptions about this industry? I think I always assumed that people would work for a large supplier full-time, it would be their job, PAYE, but actually there's a lot of gig workers as well. So tell us about that and also other misconceptions about the industry that people might not know.
Yeah, the first one, I think it's common for most instructors, is a lot of people just think you're a volunteer to begin with. So you show up a weekend morning to teach a family in your local park, and people just think you're just giving up your time. And so that's the first misconception. And then obviously the second one is you deal with a lot of schools. Most of the instructors will be working most of the time, spending most of the time in schools. And a lot of the schools do not understand that you're actually getting paid for that. And should any cancellation happen, you're probably not getting paid for that.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And it was the case that when it was called Cycling Proficiency, it was run by volunteers, police officers or parents who knew how to ride, but it wasn't standardized and there was no particular training that any instructor went through. But now we go through an initial training course and then we learn as provisionally qualified instructors for several months before we become fully qualified.
Mm. Wow, that's amazing. Because I remember doing cycling proficiency when I was a kid and cycling around the cones, and I can't actually remember who did it, but it's really interesting that people assume you're volunteers. And so I guess there's that sense that maybe you're just giving up your time, this is not your job. And it's quite interesting that obviously... well, maybe creates that impression that it doesn't matter if they cancel.
And then, like you mentioned about how the workers are actually engaged. In London, most instructors are freelance, working on a so-called self-employed basis. So all the responsibility and the financial risk is on our shoulders. The rest of the country, it varies a little bit. Some are employed on zero-hour contracts. Some are employed on fixed-term contracts. But most, arguably, are still self-employed freelance, and the industry outside of London relies on semi-retired people with a disposable income to fill in those gaps, because the hours are not sufficient to provide for a full-time worker quite often. So people without that disposable income cannot enter the industry. It's not a viable professional route for a lot of people.
And most people, this is your sole job, both of you?
Yes.
Isn't it interesting how society just seems to undervalue this massively? Because I would never assume or think that my driving instructor might do it because it's a fun, or they should be giving up time at the weekends. But I can totally believe you when you say that, a lot of people just assume it's like a hobby. But it's really hard because I taught my kids to ride bikes, and one of them was really, really struggling with it. We were able to enlist the support of a qualified cycle trainer who helped sort of one of my kids overcome a particular kind of issue, and was cycling in like 30 minutes. But, I tried to do it the volunteer way and I'm rubbish at it. So it was really, really interesting how society values or doesn't value this stuff.
Yeah,
and the job has changed dramatically since it was cycling proficiency. Cycling proficiency was very much a playground-based activity. Cycle training now starts in the playground, but as soon as the riders are able to control their bikes and signal, then we move out onto the roads near the school, and we're taking responsibility for those trainees on the road outside the playground setting.
And we're not also only talking about children learning to ride. We work with people of all ages learning to ride, but we go all the way up to the most advanced cycling. So if you were to imagine you start off with anyone in an off-road area, in a playground, in a park, assess them, and whatever level they're at, you can then teach a lesson based on their capabilities and then just keep making it a little bit more progress each time. So you start with quiet roads, and then you go into busier roads, and then you get into the very busy roads, and then you learn about advanced cycling. So there's a lot of another misconception is you only teach children how to ride a bike, and shouldn't that be the role of the parents, like you're saying? But also, we're here to support a modal shift and a transition into a clean, green transport that is cycling. And whether or not people know how to ride, we should be able to get them to a level that they're comfortable riding most days for most short trips.
Yeah. One of the most common things I hear about why people don't cycle is fear of traffic. And I guess what you're doing is giving people confidence and the skills. Is that the kind of main benefit of getting lessons to you? Or?
Absolutely. Certainly for adults who would like to ride to work. We work with lots of people who say they're scared to ride anywhere outside the park. So we'll begin in the park, somewhere where they feel safe. And then, like Swami said, we'll go out onto quieter roads, show them that they can ride, you know, quite a distance on quiet roads. And a lot of the time you can ride, you know, most of your journey on quiet roads and not have to deal with the busier roads. But a lot of the time people have only travelled on buses or in cars and only know the existence of routes from A to B on fairly busy roads.
Yeah, when often there's nice quiet routes, it's just that people don't know about them. Yeah.
Let's get into just obviously the business part you talked about, but just so our audience fully understand, if you end up at a school or working with a local authority with adults, what process do you go through to do that? Is it usually, you know, working with them directly, albeit on a freelance basis? Is it through companies, charities? And then maybe if you just at the same time also explain the Bikeability Trust as well, because I think a lot of people will have heard of that but not fully understand what it means.
So I think it's important to look at cycle training a lot from London perspective and from an outside of London perspective, because they're differently funded. So outside of London, they're funded by Department for Transport via the Bikeability Trust, which is a government quango that runs the Bikeability brand. And in London, most cycle training is funded by Transport for London. And what happens is either the Bikeability Trust or Transport for London will hand out grants to local authorities who then decide how to spend that money. Some local authorities will spend it in-house. Most of them will outsource that service. But whichever way it happens, it has to be delivered by a registered training provider. And unless you're a registered training provider, you can't deliver Bikeability.
So that's people like you. A registered training provider is people like, you know. No, so you're like another level.
Another level. Yeah. So the companies that we then work for and represent, they are the registered training providers. Yeah. Each local authority, we then tender that contract to a service provider or a training provider who compete on a number of criteria. And our pay and condition is not usually anywhere in that contract. So
How does that work? Over
the years, there is a race to the bottom. So companies trying to fight each other for council contract will then lower their prices. But obviously that maintains a perpetual lower rate of pay and worsening, deteriorating conditions.
So when they're bidding, what are they actually bidding for if they're not bidding for the instructor's time?
Good question. They usually compete. Each criteria is marked against a set parameter. So quality is marked on a set of parameters. Price is marked on a different set of parameters. But what we've heard, because we don't have access to those contracts, we don't know what they look like. It's all private, confidential information. But what we've heard through various sources is that these contracts are highly favored on price. So whoever can go lowest usually wins, not always, but usually wins. And that has led to the market in London, for example, being dominated by one single company called Cycle Confident, which has 16 or 17 local authority contracts out of the 32 boroughs in London.
And there's been a big pay increase or a funding increase from Transport for London, because we are talking about London instructors here, because London instructors are the ones striking. There's been a 66% funding increase from TfL to councils, which is 1.8 million. But your union, the IWGB, says that a very small amount, as much as £1 an hour, has been passed on to instructors when you're asking for £9 an hour for pay restoration.
Correct.
So, yeah, so I can understand why. Do you know what happened?
Good question. Will Norman, back in March this year, announced there was extra funding. Mm. He wrote to all the boroughs and said, we increased the funding by 66%, and I would like you to pass pass some of this funding on to instructors, because I've met with instructors and have discovered what I didn't know before, that there's the loss of instructors, like Laura, you mentioned before, this drop of instructors from 300 down to 150 in just a matter of 3 years or so. Will Norman wants to deliver a modal shift to get 80% of people walking, cycling, or using public transport. Part of his strategy to achieve that is cycle training.
Yeah, that's part of the mayor's transport strategy, isn't it? It's getting people out of cars and onto
modes. If he waits too long and more instructors leave, even in a few years' time, if he throws lots of money at it, there will be no instructors to deliver that training that he would like to see to achieve that modal shift.
And there's huge support among the union for the strike. 89% voted in favour of industrial action with a 95% turnout. So this is quite fairly unanimous, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. The sentiment amongst instructors are one of frustration. We have started talking about this publicly and quite loudly back in 2019. And then COVID came, and then it changed our focus a little bit. But now that there is a little bit of certainty in funding from TfL, we were able to then reshift our focus, and we engaged with everyone who would like to engage with us. Our door is always open, so this is an open invitation. If anyone out there who's listening would like to talk to us, we are always happy to talk.
This is councils and its providers.
This is councils, providers, Transport for London, anyone at the London Assembly who can look at the issue London-wide, because it's extremely fragmented. Every borough has a different contract, may have a different provider, different rates of pay, different terms and conditions.
So you're having to negotiate with all of these different boroughs?
Yes, precisely. And obviously what instructors are fed up of is listening to everyone that we talk to say, we value cycle training so much. The work that you guys do is amazing. You're changing lives on a daily basis. You're really impacting people in a positive way. Oh, what about our pay? Oh, yeah. Well, and then the conversation just collapses. So instructors have felt that there's nothing else that we can do. And obviously we treat striking as a very serious thing and to be used as a last resort. Ultimately, we don't want to be striking, but we are left with no alternatives.
Yeah, and the problem is every time we've spoken to the provider companies that we work for and asked for more money, they said, if we were to pay you more, we would have to bid higher in the contract tendering process and would not win the contracts, and another provider would win and pay you exactly what you're getting today. Talk to the boroughs, they say. So we go and talk to the boroughs. The boroughs say, well, you don't work for us, you work for the provider companies. So it's not our responsibility. We then talk to Transport for London. They said, well, you don't work for us. Go and talk to your boroughs or to the provider companies. Now, what's changed and what's unique in a sort of an industrial dispute is that at the top, they've turned on the money tap for a bit and said, you know, Transport for London said, here is some money to solve the problem. Politically, Transport for London feel they cannot dictate to the boroughs levels of pay. But they've said to the boroughs, go and meet and talk with the stakeholders and find a solution, ideally something London-wide, because we're a very small branch of a relatively small union. But at the moment, we're having to have 32 different negotiations, plus negotiations with the training provider companies. What we've said to them is, let's get together as stakeholders in one room at the same time and work out a London-wide agreement that sets a not dictates pay, but sets a threshold for pay and conditions across London, that would then avoid this race to the bottom that's been occurring for the last 14 years.
And what's the impact on you? I mean, as people who have to make a living and have bills to pay, and what's it been like for you? Well,
we're continuously questioning our commitment to the profession. You know, it's a terrible position to be in, because even though I love doing this job, I wake up and I'm motivated to go out and share my knowledge and my passion. There are days when you're thinking, maybe I should just go and find something else. It would just be easier if I just go and, you know, get another job that will have a fixed income at the end of the month. I have nothing to worry about. You know, I have three kids and times are tough. The summer months are busier, so you tend to work more to make up for the fact that in the winter there's not a lot of work around and you have to survive the drier months. So it's difficult. And obviously, this is just my personal experience. If you amplify that over tens or hundreds of other instructors who were in a similar position and having to think, you know, I'm going to jump ship, I'm going to find something else. Mm-hmm. And many have already left, as you said earlier, on average, one a week over the last 3 years. That's insane, especially given that it takes months of training plus years of crafting to become an experienced instructor. We can't afford to lose any more of this experienced workforce. And I dare to think that I might be one leaving next. But I'm extremely hopeful that the profession is going to be extremely well-funded. You know, the future of psychotraining is positive. The importance of our role in decarbonizing transport in cities like London is unique. And we are the local community champions for cycling. We could be out there on every single day of the week motivating our neighbors to get cycling and giving them the confidence and the skills that they need, not only to ride safely and share the roads with other road users, but also to access the cycles that they need. I carry my kids on my cargo bike. Today I rode my folding bike here. You know, I would love to be able to share this passion and see other families taking on cycling just like I did. And it shouldn't have to be a burden on someone to say, you know what, I'm going to get rid of the car and then start riding. But instructors are uniquely positioned to hold someone's hand and see them through that journey. And local authorities are not acknowledging that. And the fact that we lose instructors every day, it's a shame. And we have to stand up for that.
Yeah, you must see the difference that it makes every day to people in terms of taking someone from, whether they're a child or an adult, from either not being able to ride or not being very confident. And I don't know, I can imagine that's quite rewarding.
It is. It's fantastic seeing, you know, people who we taught a year or two ago now out riding. They may have a cargo bike. They might have a, you know, bike with a bike seat, and they're, you know, their whole family is now traveling, you know, from A to B by bike. And you know,
you see them around, the people you've taught.
Yeah, all the time.
And some of them, you know, have given up the car, sold it, you know, done away with it for good.
Wow.
And we're not going to, you know, this is super important, because we're not going to be able to build the infrastructure, all the infrastructure we want, at the pace that we want to, so that people wouldn't need cycle training. I think part of the kind of, you know, thought process I've gone through is, well, we need to build infrastructure so people feel safe. And that is correct. But also, you know, Will Norman's right, we're going through massive change, and to get that mode shift, you're going to have to make people feel safe doing what they can do in their local communities using the tools that they, you know, that they already have.
Yeah, and the Dutch do it, you know, the Dutch have amazing infrastructure, but they still provide good cycle training for the, you know, their whole population, you know, that is going to be using it.
Yeah, it's a good point that. And I just wondered as well whether you, because all the negotiations you're going through at the moment and the discussions you're having, you're kind of probably trying to change the numbers within the system, but keeping the parameters quite similar, i.e. the supply chain is the same. But it strikes me that, I think, talking to a colleague in my other job at a local authority, that cycle instructors were actually employed by the local authorities. And I don't know, a little bit of a challenge, but I think it's quite strange that the government are very happy to provide funding, knowing it's going on to precarious work. If you know what I mean, I can't think of other, if we, you know, well, there are other examples, but I just think that from a funding standpoint, it doesn't seem very secure, and that they can actually identify where the money is going in the supply chain that well.
We have actually asked the Bikeability Trust, to an extent TfL and Department for Transport, about the assumptions on cost. And we haven't got much clarity on that, but it's a very good point. How is it justified to spend public money in a way that you don't have the transparency required, especially around, you know, the way that workers are treated? But ultimately, we are aware of training providers in London specifically relying on a big turnout of instructors. So someone like me train up and then starts as an instructor, works a few months, feel confident enough to do my post-course assessment. I'm now a fully qualified instructor. And then over the next few months, I'll get to learn the industry. I'll get to experience cancellations. I'll get to experience being asked to work for free, like when we're doing risk assessments and reports and filling out certificates. We're not paid for that time.
Do you mean the stuff that happens outside of the lesson? So you're paid for the lesson, but there's a lot of, I've heard about this.
There's a lot of admin time that we spend that we're not actually paid for. And then after usually on average 3 years, this was up to 2019, this data, usually 3 years is the life cycle of an instructor. Someone trains up, get really good at doing it, and then they get fed up with the industry because they're not seeing progress, and then they're just hitting a blank wall. Until we unionized, there wasn't a collective voice. It would have been me and Ben in a staff room in a little local primary school just moaning at each other for the working conditions they were under. And that replicated in every other local primary school across London. And we unionized, we sat together, identified the issues, and our campaign is around pay, restoring pay to rectify 14 years of a pay freeze. Number two is paid admin time, so if it's part of the job, should be part of the pay. And number three is a fair cancellation policy, which Islington Council, in-housed instructors, already benefit from for over 10 years. The fourth one is union recognition.
Just before that, could you clarify what happens if you get cancelled? Say it's a Wednesday and you've got a week booked next week. What happens if that's cancelled?
Usually you're booked term by term, sometimes 2 terms ahead. So you could have something in your calendar for 6 months. On the Wednesday or Thursday before you get a phone call, 30 hours of your calendar could disappear like that. And most of instructors in London will get paid nothing for that week. They just disappeared. If I was working for Islington, if a school booking is cancelled within 2 weeks, I get paid 100%. If it's cancelled within 4 weeks, I get paid 50%. Most of the other providers and local authorities will cancel. As long as it's over 24 hours, you get paid nothing.
And is that, from an Islington point of view, is that because their cycle trainers are in-house and work for the council, or is it just some terms and conditions they've agreed directly with freelance workers?
So in Islington, instructors are in-housed. So I work for Islington myself. I work directly for the council. They pay me. I'm still a freelance sort of contractor, but the working conditions in Islington are, it's usually the model of what we as a branch of the IWGB want replicated across all other local authorities. The pay still the same. It hasn't improved in many, many years, but we get paid admin time, at least some, and we get paid a fair cancellation policy, which doesn't cost the council a lot more, but protects my income. Any other scenario, if I'm working in this borough here, Southwark, if I'm working Westminster where I live, if Ben is working in Haringey where he lives, it's through the same company, and the cancellation policy means that every financial risk is on the instructor's shoulder.
And how much are instructors getting paid a year for this? I presume there's not much of a buffer included in your pay for
so such. we have an hourly rate. Ben, do you want to take that?
But it works out if you're working in schools full time and doing some, you know, holiday courses and you know, occasional after school one-to-one sessions, the average pay when we've sort of surveyed instructors is sort of £16,000 to £20,000 a year
in London.
Yes,
not quite a lot, is it?
If you want to increase your yearly earnings by 2, 3, 4K a year, you'd have to work extra long days,
a lot of
weekends.
How long are we talking?
We could be talking a school plus a doctor bike is what, 10 hours plus admin time.
So we currently do, if you're working in a school, you're there from 9 till 3, but you're then expected to do a significant amount of admin time outside.
How much admin time do you think there would be in
it? There's another sort of 2 to 3 hours a week, at least, possibly more sometimes with this. If you're working in a school that you don't know the area very well, you'll have to spend a considerable amount of time getting to know the roads around that school, risk assessing, and then writing all that up.
And then presumably you have your own, I'm freelance as well, presumably you have your own kind of taxes and you have to factor in holiday.
So there's no holiday pay, there's no sick pay, there's no pension. All of that we're expected to cover out of the money that we earn.
How's your 16 to 20k a year in London?
We hear from a lot of instructors who give up on going on holiday in August because they just see that as a period to maximize their earnings. So they're just working flat out. Because there's a lot of demand, not on schools, but there's holiday courses, there's one-to-ones, there's, you know, rides, other events that people work in Monday to Monday to make up for the fact.
7 days a week.
Yeah.
Quite often seven days a week.
It's a very demanding job, the delivery of cycle training. We've spoken to some colleagues who've really maxed out and tried to do every school's course they could do, plus doctor bikes and one-to-one sessions and holiday courses and weekend work. I think the highest that somebody made was about 26,000 in a year. And after 2 years of doing that, he burnt out and gave
up. Logging themselves.
I'm gobsmacked.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, not to undermine any other careers or job paths, but, you know, the starting salary for a major supermarket in central London is £27,500 now. And they, you know, they're offering that because of the same reasons you've explained, the churn, the training, the costs of overheads. I guess that leads me to what it is that you would like. I mean, talking in general terms, you know, you've obviously talked about pay in terms of conditions, but can you be more specific with what you're, you know, what it is that you're looking for and what would make the lives of instructors better?
I think to start with, by sitting down with other stakeholders and working out an agreement. We're not saying it has to be this one thing, but we need to come to an agreement where it's recognised that the basic pay and conditions will not just keep the existing instructors in the workforce, but also bring in and retain new instructors. At the moment, the opposite is happening. At the very time when the government has said it wants to train every child in the country and provide cycle training for every adult who would like to receive it, we're losing instructors, like you said, you know, one a week.
In London alone?
Yes. And the Bikeability Trust has said that it would like to take on another 1,000 instructors in the country, but it's really quite struggling to get those extra 1,000 and then to retain the existing workforce as well. So even though it may be pulling in new instructors, they're losing them around the back.
Because of the conditions that you've just outlined.
Yeah, but those we feel could really be improved by having a London-wide agreement where no one provider or borough is undercutting the other. But rather, we would rather see those paying conditions brought up to a reasonable standard that would keep people.
Taking a sort of a long-term view of the industry as well and how this maps into the mayor's transport strategy as well, because we're funded via TfL with that purpose. The money goes to local authorities to implement the mayor's transport strategy. So looking over the next 5 years and 10 years and finding the money to ensure that local authorities have the security in funding, and then secondly, the TfL is actually interested in the long-term flourishing of the industry with a look to reach out to every Londoner, but also attract a new pool of individuals, or even attract back some who have already left to benefit from their experience to obviously support the mayor's transport strategy, regardless of where they're working.
What we've found in our discussions, we've spent the last 3 years trying to work out how on earth the industry is funded, what the sort of the pathway for the funds are, and who controls them. Since Will Norman announced the extra funding, we've found significant support for an idea of a London-wide agreement at senior sort of cabinet level in the councils, but sort of resistance at cycling officer level and at provider company level. So we would really like to sort of reach out to those individuals in those positions and say, look, come and sit down, let's sort this out. Islington, for example, to name one, has formulated this excellent agreement for Islington. But the cycling officer, sort of the head cycling officer there, says it's not really his business to try and work out anything London-wide. As long as Islington's okay, that's it. But he doesn't see any responsibility. But he's widely respected. And we feel that if he led the way, we would actually begin to get much further towards a London-wide agreement.
I wonder what, I can understand why the provider would not want to entertain, or at least, you know, the pay discussions would be more difficult. But from a cycling officer point of view, like, you know, the civil servant point of view, what's their concern generally? Or, because it sounds like Islington get it, but what's stopping others?
A good question. Sometimes they say that it's nothing to do with them and it's down to the provider company. If the provider company wants to pay us more, they can. But they don't really get it that, you know, they're controlling the amount of money that the provider company gets to then
pay us.
Can
set standards for procurement. I mean, like they did with the lorry standard in London. There's sort of procurement levers, aren't there? So if you're going to deliver, you need to pay someone X, Y, Z.
It seems like the whole market model just kind of leave. It gives the opportunity for people to say, oh, it's not my job, gov, kind of thing. And it's someone else's issue. And you have to sort of unpick the entire supply chain rather than negotiating with paymasters.
Yeah. You know, the other example that is sometimes quoted just to us is that, you know, some of our workers don't get paid very much. Therefore, why should we pay you anymore? Or sometimes what they do is sort of look at sports coaches who are working, for example, in a football pitch or a relatively low risk setting compared to the work that we're doing.
Because you're working on live roads and you're having to kind of to command traffic, aren't you, sometimes, just to sort of put your hand up to drivers, and you're doing sort of dynamic risk assessments as you're going along.
I wouldn't necessarily say we would control traffic, but we don't have the power.
Okay, have I just stepped into a bit of a...
That's lollipop ladies and... And police officers are allowed to do as instructors.
That's one of the asks, actually. They want to manage power, stop traffic.
But we are expert risk assessors and we control risk really, really well. So all the work that Ben was talking about in understanding and learning the local roads you're about to take a bunch of 10-year-olds out on, you can't just sort of go on a whim and then hope everything works out. There's a lot of thought behind. And to any onlooker, it would be the impression that, oh, that looks good. They know what they're doing. It's fine. But they would have absolutely no idea of the amount of work that went in behind the scenes to make sure that those kids were A, ready for the road, and B, that the roads that you're taking them on are appropriate for their skill levels.
Yeah. Yeah, and it takes time, I guess, to learn, doesn't it? It's not something you can just kind of magic. I wonder if it's partly this attitude we have about build it and they will come. It's like build the infrastructure and people will turn up, and kind of forgetting that actually a lot of people, if they're in the habit of doing one thing, it's quite hard to change behaviour. So this whole behaviour change part is actually very, very important, but it's often overlooked. It's not as sexy as a new bike lane or something. Yeah, but it's actually very important because you're dealing with people. You need to deal with people's behaviour and confidence.
Yes, absolutely. But also it takes, every situation is different, and usually a big life event change, getting married, moving house, having children or changing jobs, it instigates, the change in behaviour that you see why people start cycling, and having an instructor to sort of make sure that journey, whatever you started, is as pleasant and positive as possible. Because a lot of people will buy a bike, they'll just go out, and then the bike gets nicked, or they have a bad experience, and that's it. They're done. They're not going to try again for a while. And you want that everyone who has a go wakes up in the morning and think, I'm going to ride today. You want them to have a positive experience. So you want them to have an instructor to support them if that's what they want. And we can see that the role of instructors is quite unique and it's quite positive. But the whole argument is about how instructors are actually engaged with. And for years and years and years, no one was ever talking about this. So, council officers, politicians, TFL, they were making decisions that would impact our day-to-day lives, how we work, what we earn, and how we do it, without any instructor present representing the interest of instructors. And that's where the union comes in, because we have a direct contact with the workers. We're both instructors. The branch is led by members, and we understand the industry. We understand what goes on behind the scenes and what instructors are going through. And we, one way or another, we get into a platform to speak on behalf of members. And this has never happened before. So we're seeing positive changes. I think the future is looking good, but we have a lot of walls to sort of tear down until we get there.
Optimistic note, I like it.
Well, best of luck to you. It's been really interesting to hear more. I think a lot of our listeners will be aware of the importance of cycle training, but would not have known any of the detail. I certainly have, you know, when we've first discussed, been very surprised actually in a lot of this, but so much of it makes sense, and the way that we sort of pigeonhole cycle training as sort of a, you know, something that's not that important and a bit of a hobby, but actually, you know, from my point of view, you're building infrastructure. As I say, we can't build it fast enough. We need other things for the mode shift we need. But also, secondly, even when we are building it, we need those people in the community who can talk the right language to go and speak to people and say, look, actually, this is why you should support this, or, you know, doing even street audits and other tasks that it strikes me that people with your skill sets would be very, very good at. And that shouldn't be precarious work. That should be the kind of, you know, that's the linchpin of the kind of revolution that we need. So it's been really, really interesting talking to you, and please do keep us posted on how everything goes.
Will do. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And I did contact the Bikeability Trust, and I think they said 700 people have taken up their bursaries to start learning to cycle across the country. And
to become an instructor.
Yeah, to become an instructor, exactly. And they said the Bikeability Trust appreciates and values the incredible work of instructors, and it urges London boroughs and employers to discuss the funding, settlement and welfare of their workforce. And it says, as always, the Trust is here to listen to concerns and support where we can.
So. That's great to hear. Can I finish with one ask? If you're listening, do book a cycle skill session. If you're in London, it's free. Just go to TFL website and search cycle skills. If you're outside of London, go to your local authority and search cycle training. They're usually free and you learn a lot. No matter how advanced or knowledgeable you are, you will always learn something. And then if it's not for you, do tell a friend. You'll be supporting an instructor, a professional instructor like us, will come along and spend a few hours with you and be available to help you in that journey.
I had a lesson as a fairly experienced London cyclist and for an article, and I found it fantastic, actually. I learned quite a lot. It was great. So, yeah, would recommend, definitely.
Brilliant.
So thank you, Swami, and thank you, Ben. It's been great to have you.
Thank you for having
good
us.
Good luck.
So you've been listening to Streets Ahead. Our editor for this episode and all episodes has been Claire Mansell. Let us know what you think. We're on Twitter at PodStreetsAhead. And as always, if you can rate us and review us wherever you get your podcasts, that would be much appreciated. And of course, share it with anyone you think might enjoy it. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.